Wednesday, a vote to impeach President Trump is scheduled on the floor of the House of Representatives. Thursday, a debate between Democrats running for president is scheduled in Los Angeles. On Insight today, a look at both events. Impeachment is expected. The debate could be canceled. Carla Marinucci of Politico's California Playbook will join me in studio to talk about it. Also today, we'll rerun an excerpt of my conversation with Rachel Louise Snyder. She's the author of the book No Visible Bruises. The subtitle is What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And later in the hour, a scene from the 7th annual La Pastorella de Sacramento. This holiday musical opens Wednesday in Oak Park at the historic Guild Theater. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. In a few days, President Donald Trump could be impeached. Saying that sentence alone tells you where we are in history. A vote on the floor of the House of Representatives is scheduled Wednesday. You will hear NPR's special coverage that day, perhaps continuing into Thursday. Then Thursday night, a debate is scheduled in Los Angeles for seven of the Democrats running for president. It could be canceled. We'll hear why in a moment. What a week this is going to be. Carla Marinucci's in the studio with me. She is a political reporter, the co-writer of Politico's California Playbook. You might know her award-winning writing before that for the San Francisco Chronicle. This is a treat to have you in the studio.
So great to be here.
Welcome.
Really,
and why are you in Sacramento? Some assignment.
Yes. Interviews and assignments and always working with the California Playbook.
So. Okay, let's talk about the debate because Politico is a sponsor. So I figure somehow you have the inside track. You're supposed to be there Thursday.
That's right. We will be there. We have Politico has a huge team there, including Jeremy B. White, my co-author on the Playbook. And we're going to be doing interviews with Eric Garcetti and other newsmakers down there. So, yeah, we have a whole series of events planned around the debate, which is why the stakes are very high.
Will you explain the controversy, the labor issue, and how this has unfolded? And if everybody decides they don't want to cross a picket line and there are no shows.
All seven of the Democratic candidates so far have been siding with the union and are threatening not to cross that picket line. It all, you know, this is the second time it's been moved. It was originally at UCLA. There was an issue with AFSCME, another major union. But basically, it's the workers who are represented by Unite Here Local 11 that have been picketing since November. And they have an issue with Sodexo, the subcontractor that employs about 150 of them down at Loyola Marymount, where the debate is scheduled. They're saying they're not getting, negotiations. They're not getting a contract. And they have basically set up a picket line for Thursday. That set off all the Democratic candidates on Friday and set off a panic down there at Loyola Marymount. It sounds like talks are going on, and we're hoping that it's going to come off on Thursday. This is a very big event in the presidential calendar. It's a chance to see a reduced number of candidates and really have a more substantive discussion. So, we're really hoping that it's going to happen.
At the same time, the actual impeachment vote could happen Thursday.
Yeah. I mean, this is a week, as you said.
Yeah.
We've got that. You've got issues over potential government shutdown. There's only 5 days until the government shuts down. The Democrats are bracing for that. You've got the USMCA issues. You've got a lot of stuff happening in Washington, where I just came from. And now I think a lot of this is going to be brought up at the debate. Hopefully we'll get to talk to the candidates.
How is the atmosphere in Washington?
You know, Beth, I followed Nancy Pelosi around on the day that the of a critical impeachment vote, on the day the USMCA was announced. It is exhausting following her from morning till night. She does. This was a series of, I think, seven different events, including a big holiday party, including, I mean, she's 79 years old, but you cannot imagine she is the Energizer Bunny of politics in Washington. And I think people on both sides have a tremendous amount of respect for her when it comes to that. Notwithstanding, the president every day is tweeting about her, including last night, I think it was, a rather insulting tweet with regard to Nancy Pelosi. But she doesn't It just goes right off her back. She doesn't seem to be able to.
I have heard from people in California who know her that this has been a very difficult internal process for her. That this has not been just a case of take the next step that's in the book. Here's where you're supposed to go next.
Right.
That she herself has been embattled through it all.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as we know, in the beginning, she wanted this to be a bipartisan process and said that that would be much better for the country. And so I think she was really torn. But some of the revelations about the Ukraine have just been, as she said, something the Democrats cannot ignore. And she has a team, including Adam Schiff and Gerald Nadler, behind her. And yes, this is a historic week. And watching her in several of those press conferences last week, she doesn't seem to be taking any great pleasure in it, really, but feels like this is something that the Democrats have to confront. And and she's hoping that some of the Republicans will, too, with regard to overstep by the president and overreach with regard to Congress. We're going to see how it plays out on Wednesday, whether they're going to get any of those bipartisan votes. It certainly doesn't look like they will. But the Democrats are going to forge ahead, and boy, we're in for a whirlwind here.
I have to ask you, after having covered her for many, many years, and you've seen her through a long span, where is she in her life? The president often criticizes her and talks about her age or her mental faculties or whatever.
Yeah, or her teeth yesterday on Twitter. I mean, it's just
comparing to what you know. And while you answer, I'm going to adjust your mic.
I think she has said many times that, you know, basically you have to have a skin of a lizard in politics. You can't let this any of this stuff distract you. And she doesn't. She is singularly focused. And I think we saw an insight into her last week when one of the reporters asked if she hated President Trump, and she responded very passionately. Watching her last week in Washington, you just see somebody who has her caucus with her. And you know, she's famous for counting votes and knowing exactly where she stands. She is extremely effective at what she does. And I think President Trump's tweets, suggest that she's more than effective. She's in his mind. She's gotten under his skin in a very big way. I think that the Democrats wouldn't have gotten nearly as far as without Pelosi's leadership and her very calm kind of approach to this whole thing. So the nation is going to be watching how this plays out. And she's certainly the focus of attack on the Republican side, but they also admire her greatly. You can hear that. In fact, we had Laura Trump at a Politico event last week, Women Rule. That's one of the events we have. Laura Trump, the daughter-in-law of the president, asked who she most admires on the Democratic side, said Nancy Pelosi is the person she most admires because she's been in the game so long. She's willing to throw down with anybody, but she does it out of what she believes to be service to the country. So that was from Laura Trump, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Carla Marinucci is in the studio with me. A couple topics I want to hit quickly, but important to hit. When we talked last and we talked about candidates on the top of the polls and coming and going in California, we didn't give due time to Bernie Sanders.
No, we didn't. That was my fault.
Kind of got called out on that, too. And that was an oversight.
I was trying
oversight.
To list all the candidates that were going to be at the debate. And I knew I had forgotten somebody and I forgot Bernie.
Yeah, I didn't help you out either.
Bernie is here in California this week in a very huge way. I mean, he's doing an opening of his Coachella office today. He's doing town halls in Moreno Valley, in San Ysidro, in Los Angeles this week, with in Venice on Saturday with AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. That is going to be a huge event. You know, his campaign had a little bit of a setback in their endorsement of the a congressional candidate in the 25th district, Cenk Uygur, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, who was the founder of the Young Turks sort of liberal website, who had been accused of making homophobic, misogynistic comments as a radio host. He has apologized, but the fact is just about all of the Democratic establishment has gone with the other candidate, Christy Smith, the assemblywoman. So that was a little bit of a setback for the Bernie campaign. But boy, he is all over California. And, of course, the polls are showing good news for Bernie Sanders here. I think the CNN poll recently has him just a point or two behind Joe Biden. It's really a sort of a neck and neck thing right now. He's got a very strong campaign in California.
Do you think Kamala Harris voters, a good portion,
it's hard
to
know where some of them are going. You know, we watched Sam Liccardo, the mayor of San Jose last week, who was a very strong Kamala supporter, go with Michael Bloomberg. Michael Tubbs, the mayor of Stockton, also was about to endorse for Kamala Harris, went with Michael Bloomberg. Kamala Harris's supporters, her endorsement are going to be very important, I think. People are going to be watching where she goes. But at this point, I think all of the candidates are vying for those supporters. And we're seeing Pete Buttigieg here in California today. Another huge agenda of back-to-back fundraisers, including, as we speak, one in Silicon Valley that has really some of the royalty of Silicon Valley showing up there in Palo Alto. So we're going to be watching his events today. And they are going all day and all night. He's got Napa Valley. He's got San Francisco later tonight.
Seeing some of these itineraries, I don't know how
it's just incredible. He's actually been in California more than any other candidate with the number of fundraisers he's doing.
Jennifer Rubin, the ranking committee, wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post ranking 15 people who could be considered for the Democratic running mate to the nominee. At the top of the list, Kamala Harris. You know, Stacey Abrams, number two.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, I talked to Willie Brown on this last week. Of course, former mayor of San Francisco, former Ayatollah of the Assembly.
Never holding back on his opinions.
Never holding back. He was meeting on one day with Michael Bloomberg, with Joe Biden, and with Deval Patrick last week in San Francisco. And I said, you know, what's up with Deval Patrick's campaign? And he said, essentially, he's running for vice president. And, you know, that's basically what you do. If you're running for vice president, you don't run for president. That's kind of what Kamala should have done. I'm paraphrasing him, but he basically said, you know, he suggested she was running for vice president all along and maybe should never have gotten into the big race at all.
Huh. Well, he's seventh on the list, so he's kind of in the middle of the pack.
Patrick.
Interestingly,
yes.
Elizabeth Warren is below him.
Yeah.
By the way, in that same article, she cites that Joe Biden is floating the idea, or people around him are floating the idea of serving only one term.
Yes.
If he gets elected.
That's right. Politico first reported that. You know, with Joe Biden's age, he's the oldest in the field. There are people, and there's been a lot of commentary on whether he's up to it, some of his debate performances. I think a lot of people will be watching this week to see how he does. Of course, no candidate is going to say, yes, I'm only in it for one term. But there are a lot of Democrats out there suggesting that Biden is the guy most likely to take out Donald Trump, to beat Donald Trump. And then that could kind of put the country back on a sort of trajectory of normalcy. That's what you're hearing from the Democrats. And then they could move on to look toward the future.
So the politics,
a placeholder, in other words. But no candidate wants to exactly admit to being that, if that's the case.
The politics pendulum swings pretty hard one way and then the other. At some point, do we get a little bit of moderation in the middle?
It's interesting. You know, certainly when people are looking at, you know, the future and 2024, you can't count on Gavin Newsom. You know, he has an interview in USA Today where he says today, honestly, no, that's not what I'm looking at. But I think anyone in Sacramento will tell you when they look at future candidates for president, certainly Gavin Newsom's name is mentioned. So when we're talking about moderation and where the party's going, that's it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out here. It's still very early in the process, but California has, as you know, the lion's share of delegates on that Super Tuesday primary, which is why Bloomberg is here, as he was last week, and spending money everywhere he's going, dropping it all over the place with cities. And that's why he's getting these big city mayors, I think, behind him. Sam Liccardo of San Jose, being in the center of Silicon Valley, is a huge get for Michael Bloomberg. And so is Michael Tubbs. So we'll see how he does. If he can do a all-media campaign. I mean, he's already spent almost $15 million in California. That's more than most of these candidates have spent sort of combined.
Mm-hmm. And then the free media on top of it.
And the free media on top of it. So, Michael, right. You're seeing his ads nonstop out there. And that is the way in California
to reach. Back to Tom Steyer ads.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's making Tom Steyer ads look small.
Right.
So it's going to be interesting to see how he does in the polls. But he's certainly going for that lion's share of those 419 delegates that are available and up for grabs on March 3rd.
You said Governor Gavin Newsom, he rejected PG&E's reorganization plan. That rippled across the country. That was enormous news, and it leaves everybody thinking, okay, now what?
Yeah, I mean, look, the governor knows and made it very clear that the kind of power outages we experienced, a couple of months ago are not going to be the new normal. They cannot be for his, not only for his political future, but for California. He knows that's the one thing he has to get across. And so when he put out this announcement on Friday night, basically saying that the current plan falls woefully short, that's the way he put it, and then suggesting, you know, an entirely new board and a new option for takeover.
Right.
This is a game changer. This basically, you know, puts the company in the bind of having to come up with something. I mean, a judge is going to be looking at this tomorrow. They've got to come up with something to address the concerns. And Newsom made it very, very clear that it is not good enough, what PG&E has proposed. This is an issue of major concern, not only to the ratepayers of PG&E, but you're looking at the shareholders and you're looking at the nation as a whole. Is watching what's happening in PG&E, especially as people like Mayor Sam Liccardo of San Jose are suggesting a customer-owned utility. There's other plans out there for takeover. And I think Newsom knows the stakes are very, very high. The country is watching. That announcement on Friday night made national news, and he's got to get this done. So this is really job one for him, along with the other job one, which is housing and homelessness. Mm-hmm. And that's where California is at right now.
I want us to stay with that in our minds as we leave this segment, but I can't ignore the fact that Carly Fiorina spoke out today on impeachment.
Yes, I thought that was fascinating. Carly Fiorina, of course, former Republican candidate for president, former U.S. Senate candidate here in California, former HP CEO, one of the few women that has ever managed a Fortune 20 company. And yes, she came out today saying that impeachment is the right thing to do for the president. She's one of the first major Republicans to do so. As you know, she took some hits from Donald Trump back there in the campaign. Remember, he made some disparaging remarks about her face.
Right.
But the fact is, highly respected in business and highly respected in Republican circles. So we'll see what kind of impact that has and whether anyone's going to follow in her footsteps.
All right. Standing invitation in 2020 to join us again, okay?
Always happy to be here.
It is going to be a wild frontier.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Carla.
Thanks for having me.
And happy holidays,
okay,
too.
Okay, same to you.
Carla Marinucci of Politico's California Playbook. We'll post a link to the Playbook website, and you can find all of her columns. That link is at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Thank you. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In early November, I talked with Rachel Louise Snyder, who wrote the book No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. The New York Times recently named the book as one of the 10 best of the year, saying Snyder debunks pervasive myths and writes movingly about the lives and deaths of people on both sides of the equation. Rachel was the keynote speaker in November for an event at the Sacramento Family Justice Center. We've linked a conversation about the center to our webpage, too. So here's some of my talk with Rachel. She's a journalist. She wrote her book about domestic violence initially from a distance.
I had a sort of luxury that a lot of journalists have, which is that we come from the outside and try to understand something inside of it by spending, in my case, years with people who live in this reality, either victims or abusers or law enforcement or advocates. But in June, when I was in the middle of my book tour for this book, I got off the airplane to a frantic phone call from one of my oldest, dearest friends. And it turned out that her brother killed his wife and then killed himself. I stopped my book tour for a couple of weeks. She lived with me all summer. We're still sort of working through the fallout from that. They left behind two children. The oldest was one of my daughter's best friends. So my own daughter was in trauma therapy all summer. So I feel like I have personal stakes in a way that I didn't even when I was writing this book. And it just has ignited me, I think, more even than I felt before, that this has got to change, that we can do something about this.
With all you'd learned in doing the book, and your friend and her family being so close in your life, what did you recognize? Of course, I was going to ask you, or anyone would ask you, what did you see? How much of a shock was this?
You know, I think even if you recognize things, it's a shock. I think there's no way that something like this can't be a shock. I mean, everyone in my book who experienced something similar, it was a shock. I didn't know the parents that well. I knew my friend, right? So I knew that they were in the middle of a divorce and that the divorce was very messy and toxic. But apart from arranging sleepovers for their daughter, and their daughter always wanted to come to our house, they were just parents in the school that I knew. I didn't know them super well. Of course, we try now to backtrack and put things together and piece things together. And I actually can't talk about specifics too much because it's so new that it's still going, all aspects of it are still going through court probate and guardianship and all that kind of stuff. But I look at those two little girls. I just took the older one bowling a couple of weeks ago, and luckily, her aunt, my dear, dear friend who's taking care of her, is a therapist and trained in child trauma. So the girls are actually, all things considered, thriving. They're doing great at school, but they're really lucky to have that as a resource. And so many people don't.
You did not come to this topic directly. It seems that this goes back to your time in Cambodia or other countries as a foreign correspondent, and kind of this slow, maybe kind of dull realization that if all kinds of crimes were happening to women, then of course something must be happening in the home. But as you describe it, Rachel, you weren't really there yet with the awareness.
I really wasn't. And it's just astounding to me now, right? It's like looking back at the person you were when you were 15, like, how could I ever have been that person? In some ways, I'm ashamed. In other ways, I'm glad because I am teachable and curious eternally. But I did all kinds of stories that in my mind were human rights abuses, right? Women forcibly sterilized in Tibet, women imprisoned in Kabul for love crimes, child brides in countries around the world. And all of these stories had domestic violence as like sort of shadowy backgrounds, so much so that I just assumed it was there and thought, but that's not the meat of this story. This story is about this 20-year-old woman who refused to marry her, you know, brother-in-law after her husband was killed, and now she's in jail in Kabul.
So domestic violence became sort of a box that was checked on
exactly.
the way to some
exactly.
other
yeah.
crime or story.
Yeah. And it really wasn't until I moved back to the States and met some incredible people who were able to situate it and say, wait a minute, domestic violence isn't just a shadowy background. It is, in many cases, the originator of this violence. In many cases, it is like ground zero for women. We need to tackle this if we want to hope to tackle any of these other pressing social issues.
And in 8 years plus now of work on the topic, what have you come to understand about why it, domestic violence, hasn't been the epidemic, hasn't been the core focus of the conversation the way it should be in the United States?
Domestic violence has sort of emerged as a national conversation once or twice in our history, and then, you know, sort of quickly been pushed to the background again, right? It emerged when Nicole Brown Simpson was killed. It emerged when the Violence Against Women Act was passed. You know, we didn't have a federal law banning spousal abuse in this country until 1984. And I think the attitude, and this is an attitude that persists across this country, the attitude is that when you put the word domestic onto the word violence, it is a woman's problem. It is a private problem.
You actually have what you think is a better phrase for it. I've heard you say that intimate terrorism is more accurate.
Although I think that terrorism as a word is troublesome for a whole lot of reasons, we have very specific associations with it. In terms of the root of terrorism, terror, that is actually what it's like living inside a home where this kind of domestic violence exists. It's about coercion. It's really not even about the physical violence. It's about the way in which an abuser takes up residence inside the mind of a victim.
I'm jumping ahead to ask you questions like, why isn't more attention focused on the abuser? Why does an abuser behave the way he, or in some cases she, does? Why doesn't he or she stop? Why doesn't he or she leave? Those questions fall so far down the list still. And are you saying a lot of it is that idea of domestic, in the home, private, women's focused issue?
I think so. I love to quote Eve Ensler, the woman who wrote the Vagina Monologues, who says, you know, domestic violence is a men's problem. We're not beating and raping ourselves. I sort of love just the turning it on its head. I do absolutely think, I mean, when I was researching this book, there was a lawmaker I heard about in Montana who was like, domestic violence is a private problem. We're not going to deal with that in our legislation. I mean, this is a recurring issue that can happen in any constellation of, you know, women can be abusers. There's significant research now being done into LGBTQ abuse relationships. There's a beautiful memoir just out by Carmen Maria Machado on her own domestic same-sex relationship abuse, and that I really can't wait to read. So finally, I feel like we're getting some nuance to the conversation. Like, there's still sort of, I don't know, a social marketing campaign or something that needs to say, like, this is wrong. This is wrong. And take away the stigma and the shame for victims to come forward.
Will you give me the statistic that came out just before the book was published? And let's talk about whether it's reflective of more awareness and more reporting or an increase in incidents.
That is the chicken or the egg question. Right before the book came out, James Allen Fox, and I think he's at Northeastern in Boston, put out stats, post-2017 stats on domestic violence homicide, and found that in this country, domestic violence homicides were up by 33%. It used to be that we would say there were 3 women a day killed in this country, and now it's between 4 and 5. That's a huge increase. And people have asked me, you know, what is the reason for that? And we don't have causation research yet. It's too new. But, you know, I think the Me Too movement has, I think a corollary to it is that it has enabled women to say, we're angry, we're tired of this. Not just women. I don't want to imply that only women are victims, but they are the vast majority of victims are women. And, you know, it's hard to ignore the misogynistic, patriarchal attitudes of our federal government. Some in our federal government, not all.
I'm talking with Rachel Louise Snyder. Her book is titled No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. You start the book and use the case of Michelle Monson Mosier with her children, Christy and Kyle, and this man that she was married to, Rocky, as the place where you can dissect what happened and teach us and tell us. It's a horrific story. It would help if we had a little bit of the storyline. And then tell me what's happened since then.
Michelle was very young when she met Rocky. She was 14, pregnant by 15. And eventually, Rocky killed Michelle when she was 23, killed their two kids, Christy and Kyle, and then killed himself. And the case was monumental in Montana, where they lived. It was the first case that a group called the Fatality Review Team took on to look at places where changes could have been made in the system to keep her alive. She had a lot of sort of the classic markers of a situation of extreme domestic violence abuse. She was very isolated, not from his family, but from her family. She was not allowed to work outside the home. They had a very gendered role in the home. She took care of the kids and, you know, did the cooking and cleaning, and he worked essentially, not full time, but, you know, on and off. Part of the reason I'm telling the story of Michelle and Rocky is because through their story, I can answer some of these questions, like, why doesn't she just leave? Why don't victims come forward and engage in law enforcement or with local resources? Why don't victims tell their families what's going on? Why don't they go to shelter, right? And all of those questions, I just have to say, are all questions that are putting the impetus for change on the victim, which is also something that I address in the book and I think is wrong. I think we need to be asking, well, how can we intervene with him? Why is he beating her? Why is he being violent toward her?
Is it true you weren't really crazy about the subtitle of the book because it had the phrase domestic violence in it that you...
Oh, it's so true. That is an understatement. As you said, this is my third book. I really don't fight publishers on things. Like, you know, they send you things like, do you like the font of the inside of the book? Like, I have no feelings about the font that you choose for my book. The only thing I have ever truly, really fought was the subtitle of this book, you know, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us, because I felt like it was a way for it to be ignored, because I know that we have this association with domestic violence, because I know that it is how we can put aside the fact that we have these attitudes, right? I think of a book like Nickel and Dimed or Evicted and how they're really powerful in their storytelling, right? But this, I worried that it would be an easy way to ignore it if you were not already attuned to it, and also that, like, nobody would want to read it while they were on the train, because they would get that, you know, it's like reading, you know, Fear of Flying when you're on an airplane. You'll have the flight attendant come up and say, my God.
You know, with the title being No Visible Bruises, at first I thought it was going to be a memoir of sorts. I thought it was going to be some sort of personal story.
I'm asked again and again if I have domestic violence history, and I always say, like, do you ask your male journalists if they also have been?
It is a perception, a judgment on its own.
Yeah.
There is a danger assessment.
Mm-hmm.
There is an actual standard out there. I don't know how well known it is or how widely used it is, but would you say that there is a tool, please?
Yes, the dangerassessment.org. Anybody can go to it and look it up. It is the 20 highest risk indicators for domestic violence homicide. I do want to caution that it is a tool that is generally used for domestic violence advocates or law enforcement, because there is certification in giving the danger assessment. And part of that certification is that you do a timeline of the relationship right along with the danger assessment. So if you're trained as an advocate, you will do that 20-question danger assessment. And in theory, you are also supposed to do a timeline with the victim to get a sense of whether or not the violence is escalating. But if you are a victim and you're worried or you are not sure, you know, a lot of people I talk to are like, yeah, you know, he controls everything I do, but I don't think it's a domestic violence situation because he doesn't, you know, punch me. He might throw plates toward the wall, or he might do some other thing that maybe isn't recognized as that, you know, the punch to the head or the kick to the ribs or whatever. The danger assessment allows you to see really that you're not crazy, that it is domestic violence, these things that you're facing. So I think it's a great tool. It's been around for a while. It was developed by a woman named Jacqueline Campbell at Johns Hopkins, who is really, in my view, the leading voice on domestic violence research today.
DangerAssessment.org.
DangerAssessment.org.
You're listening to Rachel Louise Snyder, author of the book No Visible Bruises.
The thing we have to understand is that sometimes things like filing for a restraining order increases the violence, right? Increases the risk. We know the research tells us that the most dangerous time for any victim is when they are attempting to leave or have recently left. So there's a lot of systems where the bureaucracy can make a very complicated relationship worse in terms of risk. But also, victims very often don't go to domestic violence agencies because, and they say rightly so, why should I be the one to leave my home? I did nothing wrong, right? You don't have a burglar come into the home and call the police and the police come and say, my God, this is terrible. You've been burgled. Well, you're going to have to come with us now. The burglar is going to take up residence in your home. And that's what we're doing when we tell victims to go to shelter, really. A lot of victims reach out to their clergy members. So one of the things that I feel like is so important is to bring clergy members into any community coordinated instruction. You know, here in Sacramento, you have a former clergy member running the Family Justice Center, which is fantastic and rare. The only one I've heard of, actually. So I think that we need to train clergy. I also think there's bystander intervention research out there that people can talk about. I think the biggest thing, though, is taking away the shame and stigma. If you are a colleague, a coworker, a friend, a sibling, and you suspect that something is happening, I think you have to try to make space for victims to talk about it and to say, there's no shame here. There's no judgment here. Let's talk about what we can do.
What do you know now that you want to say to anyone who is wondering, let's start there, wondering if they're in a dangerous situation?
I think if you're wondering, it's enough to try to get out. To me, one of the hardest things is to think you are not crazy. You're not crazy. But you're also not alone. There are people who can help and will understand. You know, one of the biggest things, I'll just mention this, one of the biggest things to come out of the case of Rocky and Michelle for the state of Montana after they got together and looked at that case was they did three things to change. And these three things are so inexpensive for any community. The first is they have a dedicated domestic violence police officer. This is something you in Sacramento already have, right? So you're already ahead of the game. The second thing they did was they don't allow those arrested for domestic violence to bail out before lunch. They have to wait until after lunch to see a judge. Such a small change costs almost nothing, but what it does is it gives a domestic violence advocate or a police officer trained in domestic violence enough time to get to a victim, to do maybe a danger assessment, to do a safety plan, to change the locks, to just say to a victim, you're not crazy. That is domestic violence. You know what? If someone throws a plate against the wall and it breaks and you get cut in the cheek, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, that is domestic violence. You're not crazy. Let's fix this. The third thing they did was they created something called the Hope Card, and it's a little credit card-sized restraining order that is laminated, that has the abuser's picture on it, the areas of exclusion, the dates of the active restraining order, and victims can get as many copies of that as they need. So they can pass them out at the kids' school, for example, or to their coworkers or to their neighbors. These changes are really inexpensive. So I would say communities can do that, but what we can do as individuals is make space for people to tell their stories.
That's Rachel Louise Snyder. Her book is No Visible Bruises. You can find a link to the Sacramento Family Justice Center and Rachel's website. It's at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
Thank you.
This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Every December, the Christmas story is told all over the world with Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus. La Pastorella de Sacramento is a modern bilingual musical version of the traditional Christmas pageant staged in Mexico. This one, though, incorporates current affairs, satire, romance, along with poignant themes and moralities. Of course, there's music, so take a listen to this song you might recognize as a traditional holiday favorite.
Con mi burrito sabanero voy camino de Belén, con mi burrito sabanero voy camino de Belén, si me ven.
All right, the sound of the season. In the studio with me is the director and music director of La Pastorella. It is Carlos Candia. Hi, Carlos.
Hello, hello. How
Glad
are you?
Glad to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
And co-writer Marie Acosta is here. She's the executive director of the Latino Center of Art and Culture. Marie, happy to have you here as
Good
well.
Good morning.
We have three actors who are going to perform a scene for us in a bit. They're otherwise known as the Three Shepherds, I think. They are Alisa Starr. She plays Carmela,
Hello.
A Sacramento-born Hollywood starlet. You've come back home and you have fallen on hard times.
Yes, that's, yes.
Thank
that's
you,
what's
Alisa.
Happening. Thank
to
you.
Have you here. Pano Roditis, did I do that right?
Yes, you did,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, plays Armando. He's a young local developer, and he's about to score a big contract for some housing in Oak Park.
That's correct.
All right, great to have you here. And Angel Rodriguez is here. He plays Juan. Juan is an Afghanistan war vet turned stand-up comic.
That's right.
All right, somebody's putting a spin on the Christmas story here. Is that you, Carlos? What are you doing with the story?
Well, this year, this is the first year that I direct, like, the whole thing. So it's, like, super hard. But this year, I want to change the play and put more movement on it. So make it more alive. And yet, it's going to be a little bit more of a Spanish because that's my first language. And actually, my English is not very good looking, as we say. but it's been an amazing experience and actually working with such a professional actors. And I think, like, I don't know what to teach them because they're amazing. So it's been an amazing experience to do this.
Marie, would you say something about the traditional Christmas pageant and then the spin that happens in this show?
Pastorelas are really very ancient traditions. It comes from hundreds and hundreds of years back, and it's morphed into something that in Mexico, and I'm not sure in other Latin American countries, but I know in Mexico they're done in communities, they're done on the streets, they're done in churches, and they all have kind of a different take. More often than not, they're humorous and they're secular. So we took that tradition and created a take on it that takes place here in contemporary Sacramento. And there's a great twist. So I think if you come to see the show, it'll be, oh, wow, okay. Because it's traditionally about the shepherds that go to find the Holy Family sent by San Miguel on this mission. And they're encountered by devils along the way. And they try to tempt them so that they don't get to the Holy Family. So ours has a surprise ending.
So who grew up with the idea of a Christmas pageant? Angel?
I did, yes. I was born here in Sacramento, but my parents were from Mexico. So I grew up going to church, Catholic church. And in the church, every single year, it was a tradition. We would have La Pastorella, we would watch it, and then break a piñata and just all the Christmas celebrations. Every single year since I can remember, I've been watching a Pastorella.
Were you ever in one before?
No, not until 3 years ago when I started doing this project.
Ah, good. Alisa, how about you? Tell me about the tradition you grew up with.
So I am from Puerto Rico. So it's a little bit different in Puerto Rico. We don't have like the pastorela. So this is kind of new for me. But we do celebrate Christmas. Like it's like a family tradition where we reunite with our family. We make a lot of food. There are like a lot of parties for us. But it also has a meaning for us. I grew up in the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. so yes, so it does have a pretty meaning for us. Yes.
Did you do any singing, dancing? Were you in any of the shows as a little girl?
Yes, I'm actually a singer, so that's what I do. And for me to be part of this play, La Pastorela, it's been such an amazing experience. It's something completely new for me. So I'm really grateful for them for having me as part of the cast. This is my first experience as an actress. So it's been challenging. It's been really challenging, but it's been a wonderful experience at the same time.
That's Alisa Starr, and we heard from Angel Rodriguez. That means it's your turn, Pano. What was your childhood experience and tradition with the holiday?
Well, funnily enough, I'm Argentinian, but I'm also Greek. So growing up, a lot of our Christmas traditions were around the Greek Orthodox Church. So while I wasn't performing in the pastor story pageants, I was performing in my Greek Orthodox Church, doing singing, doing anything they would put me into, because my parents knew I was a performer and I loved everything about it.
It's nice if they called you a performer and not just a little ham, right?
Well, that was also probably said. But so that was kind of my experience growing up. In terms of, I think one of my favorite parts about the Argentinian side of things was, it's called the Los Tres Reyes, the Three Kings. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a tradition after Christmas where I always called it the Christmas insurance, because anything I didn't get for Christmas, I would complain about in those like 7 weeks between Christmas and the Three Kings, and then I would get it.
Kids are so smart, aren't they? All right, so I think it's time to hear a scene. It's wonderful to hear all your voices. Marie, do you want to give a little bit of setup?
Yes, and I also want to mention that 30 minutes before the show, we will be doing a posada, which is where you will hear El Burrito Sabanero with our Coro de Sacramento, led by Peter Baird, our music director. So please come way before the show so you can join us in the posada. So this scene that we're going to do is when Saint Michael, San Miguel, first meets up with the shepherds, Los Pastores, and sends them on their mission.
La Pastorela opens on Wednesday. Here is a scene live in our studio.
Greetings, shepherds. Do not fear. No temáis, pastores.
Shepherds?
Yes, shepherds. There is a family that needs your help. They are traveling on foot. They fled with nothing but a blanket for their unborn child, a baby who represents a future of hope, of peace, and of love for the world. I searched the earth to find four intelligent, humane, deserving individuals to make a dangerous journey to protect the family and to give their baby a future. Evil forces will try to turn you back. They will prey on your weaknesses. You will face temptation. Will you accept this challenge?
No.
No. Gila, Armando, Juan, Carmela, you must put the good of others before your own. If not...
Food, fire, famine, and the end of the world. Like the fire in paradise, the flutes in Venice, famine in Somalia?
Exactly. Go to the city of Sacramento. You will find the baby wrapped in swaddling clothes and laying in a shelter. Find the family. Protect them. And bring peace to the world. Follow the star.
But we are in Sacramento.
This is a raid. Nobody move. Nobody leave. Round them up. Show us your papers. You're getting deported.
Pero soy un former Marine. I served in Afghanistan.
Move it.
I'm a famous Hollywood actress. You can't do this to me.
Yeah, sister. I've heard that one before.
No. I'm a dreamer. DACA.
There must be some kind of mistake. I'm Mr. Compratieras, and I'm friends with all the city council members.
Nah. Let's go. Vamos. Let's go. Go back where you came from.
That was easy. Maybe this year, the boss is right.
I'm hooked. That was terrific. That was a scene from La Pastorella de Sacramento. It opens Wednesday, December 18th, with shows on Friday and Saturday, and also one on Sunday, it looks like, with the procession, too. With me in the studio, you heard the director, Carlos Candia, in multiple roles there, multiple hats. You also heard the co-writer, Marie Acosta, along with actors Elisa Starr, Pano Roditas, and Angel Rodriguez. I think you must have a lot of fun in the productions, in the rehearsals. Yeah. How much influence have you had on Carlos and Marie in the writing? Anybody?
Well, our co-writer, Tomas Benitez, okay, who lives in Los Angeles, and I, we're pretty strict with the actors, although they do some wonderful ad-libs. It's pretty much, don't change my lines.
And there's music throughout and celebration.
Great music.
As well.
Oh, my goodness. The singing is absolutely wonderful. Wonderful.
Well, thank you. You go ahead, Carlos.
It's a, I want to take advantage of this to mention the writer of the songs. He's from Colombia. I'm from Colombia. So we get this very talented guy, Jorge Roballo, who wrote the whole songs, and we incorporate the songs to the script. And it's been a very good and an interesting job because he was there and I was here and we were like working like miles away, and everything works fine, and the music, it's amazing. The music is so beautiful.
It's obvious this is a project with a lot of creativity and a lot of passion. Thank you so much for your willingness to come in and share it with us.
Thank you, Ben.
Good luck. And in
Merry
all the
Christmas.
Ways you
Feliz
celebrate.
Navidad.
Yes. Happy holidays. Actually, we're going to close with Feliz Navidad. I want to again say that these performances are presented by the Latino Center of Art and Culture, the LCAC, at the Historic Guild Theater in Oak Park. We'll post a link for more information. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak with producers Helen Barrington and Cynthia Lopez. For now, we're going to close with more of the music of the holiday, more from La Pastorella. Feliz Navidad.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad.